serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors, with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at ColeraineBank.com. Member FDIC. The Bemidji Senior Center hosts a Medicare presentation Wednesday, September 3rd at 1 p.m. Learn about the plans available before open enrollment, which begins October 15th. Now for As It Happens.
Hello, I'm Neil Cooksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens,
The Balance of Power, we'll check in with a former ambassador to China as Xi Jinping meets with his counterparts from Russia and India, sketching out an alternative to American global influence.
And author and investigative journalist Lyndon McIntyre takes us deep into the hidden history of Hugh Tudor, who played a pivotal role in atrocities in Ireland, including the Bloody Sunday Massacre, before living quietly in Canada for decades.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Monday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on member-supported KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm-fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series Thursday, September 4th at noon. This month, learn about stormwater runoff and the problems it can cause. Register at itascawaters.org. And we receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. And Grand Rapids Riverfest is this Saturday. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. And now I want to play a tune for you from one of the artists performing. This is Jeremy Albino with the song Amelia.
Well, I was meant to walk this earth. You were meant to fly. Tell by the way you look up there. See it in. Told you to run. Got your head up in the clouds. You're always stuck in the sky. On the day you left the sun, you never said goodbye. 'Cause once your feet nothing could keep you down. Oh, Amelia, flew too close to the sun. Oh, if I knew you, would have told you to run. A girl who's long been dead and gone, I sure got it bad. I'm a weak man for your love, love I'll never hate. 'Cause once your feet got off the ground, nothing could keep you down. Oh, Amelia, flew too
could have been the one.
That's Jeremy Albino with the song Amelia. You can catch Jeremy Albino at Grand Rapids River Fest this Saturday, along with Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens.
Darkest hour. Late last night, an earthquake hit Afghanistan, killing hundreds of people and injuring thousands. An aid worker there tells us about the moment everything started shaking and the devastation for families in the mountains near the epicenter.
Rule of three. As the world wonders what role the United States will play in global politics, the leaders of China, Russia, and India gather to present a united front and a potential photo op of the future.
Slime pickings. A rare lefty snail found in New Zealand needs another rare lefty snail to reproduce. Ned's owner tells us about the nationwide campaign to find one before it's too late.
A history of violence. In his new book, investigative journalist Lyndon McIntyre tracks the little-told story of British Major General Sir Hugh Tudor, who headed the notoriously brutal Black and Tans in Ireland.
An unsettled resettlement. Tudor was never held accountable for his crimes there and lived the last four decades of his life in Newfoundland. My feature conversation with Lyndon McIntyre is coming up.
And costume drama. Facing abominable approval ratings, Peru's Congress takes drastic action to turn things around by creating an adorable mascot named Congresito. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that doesn't usually support a puppet government. It was nearly midnight in eastern Afghanistan when the earth started to shake. A 6.0 magnitude earthquake struck just outside Jalalabad. At least 800 people are believed dead and thousands more injured. Many of those affected live in remote mountain villages, hard places for rescue and aid efforts to get to. Maysam Shafi is the Norwegian Refugee Council's communications and advocacy advisor in Afghanistan. We reached him in Kabul.
Maysam, you felt the earthquake when it hit. Can you describe what that was like?
Yeah, it was around almost 12 midnight when I felt a strong earthquake. And it was almost unusual for me here in Kabul to feel something like that. It woke me up. Usually it's like between, let's say, 5 to 10 seconds, but it was, I'm assuming, was like between 10 to 15 seconds or even more than that.
It probably felt like an eternity, I can only imagine, not even 10 or 15 seconds. The epicenter is to the east of Kabul in the province of Kunar. Can you describe for our listeners what that region is like?
Unfortunately, it's really bad, and this devastating earthquake has destroyed almost everything in the villages. One of my colleagues told me this evening that he faced a family, a father, who had unfortunately lost three of his kids. Mm-hmm. The oldest one was 7, the middle one was 3, and the youngest one was 2. And the father was speechless. He had told to my colleague that he's so disappointed from this world, unfortunately. And it's not easy to lose 3 kids within a few minutes. And then my colleagues also was saying that he has seen the area that he had visited for this assessment, he had seen everywhere were destroyed and almost everything has been on the ground. The people, like the residents of this area, had to leave the area because of the other earthquakes that are happening after the main earthquake, and they are in an open area currently. All these families have almost nothing, and they have lost everything that they had under their rebels.
This is a rural area, as you said. It's remote, but also mountainous. There are difficulties getting aid and getting help. How are people getting medical attention? Where will the people you've described stay?
So, according to the reports, many of the injured from last night's earthquake were taken to the Asadabad hospital. Many routes leading to the villages that were strongly hit are unfortunately blocked, and it's not easy to take the aid quickly to those areas. What we have noticed is the Afghan authorities, currently they are using helicopters to take those who are injured and bring them to the hospitals.
Afghanistan and its people are already dealing with so much, particularly under Taliban rule. You know, they're dealing with a hunger crisis. The impact on women is devastating, we know. How is all of that affecting who gets help and how much help comes in?
Unfortunately, Afghanistan is facing and dealing with different crises. The level of poverty is very high. The rate of unemployment is very high. Recently, we had millions of Afghans who were forced to return back to Afghanistan. And already almost 23 million people in Afghanistan are in need of humanitarian assistance. So the emergencies that are coming, such as this earthquake, will be an additional crisis on the already double or multiple crises that Afghanistan has. So it's really hard for the humanitarian organizations to address these crises separately, whereas the funding every day is being shrinked.
The funding is shrinking. We know the Taliban is asking for international help. As I came in to speak with you, the latest on the wires is that no countries had offered that aid yet. How likely is it, do you think, and that may change certainly as things progress, but how likely is it, do you think, that international help will come, given that it's been dwindling, given the current government, the Taliban, in Afghanistan?
We are optimistic. As a humanitarian organization, we request the international community to look to the people of Afghanistan who are in need. They need to scale up these humanitarian funding, which directly comes to the humanitarian organizations. And then we, as the humanitarian organizations, implement those projects and provide assistance to those Afghans who are in really need or in bad need.
Maysam, I'm glad we could speak, and I'm glad you and your family are all right. Thank you very much. Please take care.
Thank you so much for having this conversation with me.
Maysam Shafi is the Norwegian Refugee Council's communications and advocacy advisor in Afghanistan. We reached him in Kabul. They're not renowned for their cheeriness, but today during a photo op at a security summit in China, Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin, and Narendra Modi were all smiles. The Chinese leader welcomed the Russian president and Indian prime minister and more than 20 other world leaders to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit in Tianjin. China organized the meeting to build on its international relationships and present itself as an alternative to the U.S. as a world leader in the face of Donald Trump's unpopular tariffs. China, Russia, and India represent the three largest powers not aligned with the West. Their display of unity could signal a significant shift in the world order. Guy Saint-Jacques served as the Canadian ambassador to China from 2012 to 2016 and as a senior fellow at the China Institute at the University of Alberta. We reached him in St. Lambert, Quebec.
Guy Saint-Jacques, what do you see when you look at that photo of Xi, Putin, and Modi?
Well, I see some people who seem to be very happy, and I think we have to realize that China is making huge progress in its quest to become a major superpower. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization was created by China and Russia back in 2001. It was a relatively small organization, not very important, until Xi Jinping came to power at the end of 2012. And Xi Jinping, when he came to power, wanted China to take its place back in the world, but also because he was dissatisfied with the place that China was getting in an existing international organization. He started to create its own organizations like the BRICS, which where Russia and India are also member, but also he gave a new life to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and now it's a group that has 10 members. And in fact, at this meeting, there are also 16 other countries that are either observers or line up to become members eventually.
So it sounds like you see more than just a photo op and you know, optics. It sounds like you see actual power and progress, at least from China's standpoint.
Definitely. It's the most important regional group. When you look at the participants, it represents about 25% of world GDP, about 45-46% of the world population. And Xi Jinping is using this summit to demonstrate that China is a reliable partner, one that respects international law, that favors the United Nations, that supports free trade and globalization. He wants also to portray China as a champion of the global South. Clearly, what unites many, if not most, of the participants at that meeting is that they don't like the United States. They don't like especially where the United States are going under Trump. And I think that Trump is helping a great deal the plans of Xi Jinping. What Xi Jinping has been talking about for a while, this notion of a multipolar world where the United States is no longer the main superpower that dictates the rules of the game, is taking shape. And I think that we need to pay attention to that, because I think otherwise our interests and values could be threatened.
What's your sense? You mentioned the United States, of course. What is your sense of how this meeting is being viewed there? And perhaps more importantly, how the U.S. might respond? What kinds of things we might see from the White House? Yeah.
When Trump came to power, he said that its main international goal was to limit the growth of China. And China is perceived as making very rapid progress on the technology front. We know that a lot of money is going to make its army better trained, better equipped. But if he had thought about his strategy, clearly he would have tried to court countries like India to try to get India on the U.S. side. But rather than doing this, he has antagonized the Indian prime minister by imposing tariffs of 50% because India buys a lot of Russian oil. By the way, China also buys a lot of Russian oil, mm-hmm. but President Trump doesn't dare putting in place similar tariffs because he knows that Xi Jinping would cut the export of critical minerals, rare earths, and magnets to the U.S., which would cripple the U.S. industry.
And then, of course, the very important question for Canada and Canadians is, what is Canada's balancing act right now from where you sit? We know what it's trying to do with the U.S., but also we've got the canola situation with China, crippling tariffs there for that industry. What is Canada's balancing act as you see it right now?
Well, Canada is more and more in a difficult position because we have benefited from the world order that was put in place after the Second World War. We were able to work closely with the United States. In fact, we became dependent on the United States on many fronts. Now we see that we are faced with a leader there in the person of Donald Trump that cannot be trusted, that is not reliable. And this exacerbate the need to diversify our markets. And I think the challenge for Canada will be to work closely with allies. And of course, I cannot include the United States in my definition of allies, but we have to work with European countries, with Australia, New Zealand, Japan, South Korea, mm-hmm. to try to protect the elements of the international system that we need, that Canada, a country of our size, needs to function properly. And this will need to develop common positions when we deal with the United States, but when we deal also with China. And so this will require a major effort. There will be a lot of work for my former colleagues, diplomats.
Guy Saint-Jacques, as always, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Guy Saint-Jacques is a senior fellow at the China Institute at the University of Alberta. He served as the Canadian ambassador to China from 2012 to 2016. He's in St. Lambert, Quebec. Is New Zealand's newest and most eligible bachelor. And at the risk of betraying my journalistic objectivity, he is gorgeous. In photos, his eye stalks seem to look right through you. But Ned the Snail has a certain idiosyncrasy that makes romance challenging. Like his Simpsons namesake, Ned Flanders, Ned is a lefty, meaning his shell coils to the left and not to the right. That makes him very rare and very lonely. Unless he can find another left-coiling snail, Ned is doomed to live a life of celibacy. But Giselle Clarkson, who found Ned, is not giving up. She has teamed up with New Zealand Geographic on a nationwide campaign to find Ned a mate with curves in all the left places. We reached Ms. Clarkson in Wairarapa, New Zealand.
Giselle, what do you think? If someone had told you a month ago that you would be playing matchmaker for a world-famous snail, would you have believed them?
Absolutely not. No way. No way. This has been so strange and unexpected, and it's just one of those times where you think, what is life?
I hear you. Where is Ned now?
Just next to me. Ned is in a fishbowl. Okay. On the shelf in my lounge. Just sliding around. It's what Ned does.
From what you can tell, Ned is okay with his new environment.
Yeah, Ned seems fine. Okay. And I mean, in fact, I would say completely oblivious.
To all the excitement, all the people pulling for him and his future. So tell us about the moment. So we're talking about garden snails, common garden snail, except Ned is a special case. When did you realize what you were looking at here?
Pretty quickly. It only took me a moment. So I pulled up a plant in my garden, and a snail tumbled out into the dirt, and I was just about to scoop it up and just chuck it off to the side, and I stopped because something looked unusual.
Yeah, and so you knew that they existed, and had you seen one before?
No, never, because they're so rare. One in 40,000. We had a really wonderful letter from a German snail enthusiast just yesterday, and he was saying that in 60 years of admiring snails, he's just found his third left coiling snail.
Wow. So being a lefty, though, for Ned is what the big problem is. It's cool to be rare and special, but that means there's a lot of help needed to find a mate. Why does it make it, for people who aren't as knowledgeable about snails as you are, why is it so hard for them to find a mate?
So Ned, like all snails, is a hermaphrodite. Mm-hmm. So neither male nor female. So all the snails have the capacity to produce both sperm and eggs, which means that in a typical situation, any snail can, well, of the same species, can slide up next to any other snail and exchange bits, and away they go. So that makes it really, really simple for most snails. But for Ned, with a left coiling shell, it means that they're reproductive organs are on the wrong side. Like, the physical compatibility doesn't work. They'd have to contort themselves into all sorts of weird positions to try and make their bits line up with a right coiling snail. So it just doesn't happen.
So there's this campaign on with New Zealand Geographic, as you mentioned. The article and the illustrations are quite lovely there as well. What is the ultimate hope here? What do you want people to do?
Well, we would love for people to go outside and look for a partner for Ned, basically. We want people to get out into their gardens or into parks or rummage around in the hedge and see if they can find another lefty. And then report back to us at New Zealand Geographic, and then we'll try and organise a date for them and see what happens.
You mentioned the letter that you got from the gentleman who's seen a few over, you know, quite a long time, 60 years, as you mentioned. But what about the rest of the response? What kinds of things are people saying and writing?
We've had an incredible enthusiastic response from all around the world. And we know that there are lots of people in New Zealand out looking. But so far, no luck on the lefty front. We're still waiting.
Well, longtime listeners of As It Happens may remember that we have covered another very similar saga in the past. It was the one of Jeremy the snail. Jeremy was also a lefty. Jeremy's owner, Angus, found two left-coiling snails for Jeremy. But that love triangle led to kind of an unfortunate situation for Jeremy. Well, let's play a little bit of that interview.
And so we got them all together in the hope to do some genetics. Unfortunately, kind of in the same way that sometimes, you know, you might have a someone you're interested in romantically, you introduce them to your best friend, and of course that person goes off with your best friend. So that's what's happened. The bad news is the two snails have gone and reproduced with each other rather than ignored Jeremy.
I mean, could there be a more tragic outcome? What if the same thing happens to Ned? Are you prepared for that kind of responsibility?
Yeah, we're prepared. Yeah, I'll be on hand to provide counselling and emotional support. Yeah, you know, it could happen, because just because you've got physical compatibility, it doesn't mean that sparks are going to fly and the chemistry will be there. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to see. But that will be part of the fun. You know, that would be fascinating to observe the process if we do get two lefties together.
But you mentioned wanting to get people out in their gardens. A lot of people love snails. I think they're really cool, but not everyone does. It's not a universal feeling, and especially there. So what are you hoping comes of this as people explore their gardens?
Yeah, well, that's really the heart of this whole thing, is encouraging this connection to nature. And snails are one of those things that are just so often overlooked or ignored, or just, you know, they're considered a bit annoying. So people don't take the time to realize what magnificent creatures they really are.
One very important question before we let you go. This magnificent creature, we want Ned to not be alone, but what if Ned wants to be alone.
That's just fine.
Ned gets to decide in the end.
Ned gets to decide. There's absolutely no pressure, you know. I'm okay. Very supportive of everything Ned wants.
That makes me very happy to hear, Giselle. This was a pleasure. We will stay in touch, but I thank you for your time. Thanks.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Giselle Clarkson is an author and illustrator who found and now takes care of Ned, the lefty snail. She's in Wairarapa, New Zealand. In July, the president of Peru, Dina Boluarte, issued a decree. She was doubling her own salary. And why not? People couldn't dislike her anymore. Her approval rating is 2%, as in 2 out of 100. Now, relatively speaking, Peru's Congress is basking in public adulation, but only relatively speaking, because Congress's approval rating is around 10%. Now, you couldn't call these numbers surprisingly bad because they're not surprising. The president and Congress are dysfunctional and ineffectual, accused of doing nothing to fix a serious problem with organized crime and doing a lot of things to make that problem worse. Also, more than half of the 130 members of Peruvian Congress are under investigation for various offenses, including corruption. Under fire, then, you would hope that Congress would try something new, and they have. They made a costume of Peru's legislative palace with a face on it and their new mascot, which they've named Congresito, or Lil Congress.
Él es Congresito. Es un personaje singular que vive y trabaja en el Congreso. Seguro que lo has visto en las visitas guiadas, siempre feliz, saludando a todo el mundo como si viviera en Disneylandia. Pero lo que nadie te cuenta es que...
Congresito! He's so cute. He's having so much fun. He's waving and smiling and high-fiving visitors. The voiceover tells us he lives and works at Congress. He's always happy, greeting everyone as if he lived at Disneyland. You are hearing me correctly. Facing catastrophically low public support due to corruption and incompetence, a legislative body scoured its conscience and chose to distract everyone with an adorable little guy who is a building with eyes. It's a fascinating solution, insofar as it's inventive, insulting, and not at all a solution. Peruvians needed them to face their problems, not put a face on a problem. Here's Faye Webster with Better Distractions. Webster with Better Distractions.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, former CBC journalist Lyndon McIntyre joins me in the studio for a conversation about his new book.
It's called An Accidental Villain, and it tells the story of a British man exiled in Newfoundland for decades, hiding from his past and from those who knew about his involvement in atrocities committed during the Irish War of Independence. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, Alyssa Ellen. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pokegama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities needed for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more jazz Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. And we receive support from the McKnight Foundation. Minnesota Mixtape is our deep dive into the local music scene, Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at 3 p.m. with host Malachi Coons. Now back to As It Happens.
For decades, Hugh Tudor lived a quiet life in Newfoundland and Labrador. He was a member of a golf and country club. For a while, he worked in the codfish industry. And in 1965, when he was in his 90s, he died, 40 years after he'd arrived in the province. That uneventful life was in stark contrast to his years before his arrival. After fighting in the First World War, Mr. Tudor's friend, a man named Winston Churchill, who was the war secretary at the time, called on him to go to Ireland as part of the British fight against the IRA in the Irish War of Independence. And once there, he became the chief of a police force that included the brutal division known as the Black and Tans. That force ran a violent campaign that included burning properties and villages and state-sanctioned murder. And that is just part of the story in a new book by former CBC journalist and Fifth Estate host Lyndon McIntyre. He did extensive research on Major General Sir Hugh Tudor's 3+ decades of active service in the British Army and the 4 decades of exile he lived thereafter in Newfoundland. Lyndon's new book is called An Accidental Villain, A Soldier's Tale of War, Deceit, and Exile. It's published by Penguin Random House Canada, and it's available now. Lyndon McIntyre joined Neil in our Toronto studio.
Lyndon McIntyre, welcome back to the AIH studio.
Well, it's weird to be back.
It's great to have you, though. You've been on this side of the mic, I know, too. So a pleasure to have you here. Why did you want to spend so much time, because you worked on this for quite some time, why did you want to spend so much time with this soldier's story?
Well, first of all, I'm a sucker for a good story. The person at the center of this story is a very interesting guy, and nobody knew very much about him. I didn't know anything about him. And I wondered, how can you be a historically important figure, interesting person, involved in a very important chunk of history in a notorious way, and nobody knows anything about you? So that was intriguing. When I started to find out things about him and what he was involved in, I started to get a resonance with stuff that's going on today. Mm-hmm. For example, he was brought into a political crisis in Ireland. He was an army general with no police experience, but the powers that be decided that they were going to define this political crisis as a crime wave, and that they were going to treat the people who were behind it as criminals, and that they were going to hand it over to a police force. And they decided they needed a tough guy to run that police force. And I thought, you know, that sounds a lot like what's going on some places today, you know, where you take political problems, you repackage them as crimes, and you repackage political adversaries as criminals, and you go after them with a big stick. The other thing that resonated for me, but here was a guy, and we're getting ahead of the story a little bit, but you'll take me back. Okay. Here's a guy who was a hero in the First World War. He was 10 times mentioned in dispatches. He was promoted to Major General Divisional Commander. He was the youngest divisional commander in the British Army in the First World War. Here's a guy that comes out of the war. He's got a happy little family, 4 young children, and a devoted wife. And he's getting ready to do the next section of his life in 1920. His old friend Winston Churchill calls him up and says, will you help me out in Ireland? We got a problem in Ireland. We got to put down this revolution. And he says, sure. He gets over there, and he decides after he's there, he's dealing with an insurgency. Mm-hmm. Using tactics that we now describe as terrorism. And he and his little team that he brought in, they were all military officers, they decided the only way you can deal with terrorism is by being a terrorist yourself. Mm-hmm. So he throws away the rule book.
Yeah.
He forgets about his reputation as a disciplined professional military officer. He forgets about his family. He abandons them, basically. And he begins to serve this patriotic ideal blindly. He begins to serve his friend Churchill with unthinkingly. And after 20 months of that, everything else, nothing else in his life matters anymore. No family, no career, no heroic record, and he's a fugitive after that. So I hope that anybody who reads this book, who happens to be in law enforcement or military or in public service anywhere, remember that you've got to follow your own moral compass. And the day you you compromise that in service of political big shots and ruthless people in politics serving really bad ideas, you will be doomed by history. Your grandchildren will be saying, was that really my granddad who did that stuff? And that's where we find General Tudor today.
One of the complicating factors for you in telling the story is that Tudor didn't leave a memoir or any journals from his career, or specifically his time in Ireland. But you did have other materials to work with, other people you could speak with, history books, newspapers, people who knew him. As well, you had the letters between Churchill and Tudor. They're very telling. That relationship was clearly key to him getting this surprise job in Ireland. And you write about how the police force changed after Tudor's arrival. You write that the black and tans were, quote, mostly Englishmen working for the money, fundamentally contemptuous of Ireland and the Irish, volatile when aroused by a predictable hostility among the civilians they encountered. And that, quote, the auxiliaries were mercenary soldiers working without rules in a place they thought of as a foreign country, among people many of the Oxys considered to be subhuman, unquote. So that really illustrates the hatred. And I mean, this isn't policing as it is supposed to be.
Yeah.
And the violence that follows, pages and pages of it, you describe vividly. I mean, the brutality is staggering. Can you describe a little bit of that, you know, the circumstances, the dynamic that take us to Bloody Sunday in Dublin in 1920?
Before he got there, the British policy was to try and contain this, because the IRA had adopted late in 1919, they adopted a policy of intimidating police officers, because the police officers were known as peelers. They were members of the British establishment. They were Irishmen mostly. But so if you attack these Irish coppers who are being paid by the British government and you drive them out of their jobs, that sort of the wheels of justice begin to slow down. So they started intimidating. They started boycotting them. They started killing them. And by early 1920, they were killing a lot of them. Most of them were responding by quitting their jobs. Hundreds a month were quitting their jobs and just can't take this anymore. Their families were being intimidated. So anyway, the British establishment says, the government said, well, we will replace these people with people who are not so easily intimidated. British Army, English and Scottish mostly, war veterans who hated the Irish anyway because of the mistaken belief that the Irish really didn't do much in the First World War. The Irish did a lot in the First World War. There were three divisions of solid Irish.
Just the dehumanization of people.
Let me betray a little bit of my own Celtic background here. Like, it's very easy for someone of British, Anglo-Saxon background to look down their noses at Celts, especially the Irish, the bog Irish, they used to talk to them. They did treat them as dirty, filthy, mostly Catholic, awful people. So anyway, these guys go in there with that attitude, and they were hiring so many of them that they couldn't properly put uniforms on them. So they were patching uniforms together with army, police, whatever. The police uniform was dark, dark, dark blue, almost black, and the army uniform was khaki. So these guys were wearing this mix-up, and the Irish, of course,
you're gonna get
they put a label on anybody. So these fellas were all sooner or later being called the Black and Tan. And the Black and Tans became notorious. And anybody connected then with British law enforcement was considered to be a Black and Tan. The Auxiliary Division had their own uniforms, but they were all called Black and Tans. The whole RIC eventually were just being called, if you were a nasty police officer, you were a tan. and the tens started getting knocked off. Tudor comes in, and the thing that I found most interesting in the whole research was that they decided in May of 1920 to put a hardball player at the head of the Royal Irish Constabulary. So they looked around for a few people, and out of the blue, Churchill says, "I got the guy." Churchill was the Minister for War, and he was a big voice in the cabinet. He says, "I got the guy I want." And it took them 3 days to pull him out of retirement and put him to work in Ireland. Now, he had to have foreknowledge of this, I believe. And then a week later, within days, he had a half a dozen really hardball players from his wartime experience. One of those guys is writing to Dublin Castle, an official there. He says, "I have been informed of our policy. I don't know if it's going to work, but our policy, to sort of paraphrase it, it means secret murder to deal with murderers, and terrorism to suppress terrorism. That was the policy." 5 days after that, General Tudor himself is sitting down in a very private dinner, one other person, with the Prime Minister of Great Britain. Now, this is less than a month after Churchill pulled him out of nowhere and put him in that job. Less than a month, he's advising the Prime Minister, here's what we're going to do. We need your support. Prime Minister says, go for it. Next day in cabinet, the Prime Minister is saying to the British cabinet, "I've had a meeting last night with General Tudor. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to have to make a few changes in the rules and the laws in order to open things up a bit."
Become lawless, essentially.
And away she goes from there. And Tudor's black and tans, just generally speaking, begin to inflict chaos on the Irish population.
The only reason that it ended, those years brutality and bloodshed, the public opinion starts to shift outside. I mean, in England, there are political consequences potentially for the government. Mm-hmm. They're not worried because people are dying. They're worried because it might impact them politically. There's some outrage from British officials as well. You know, we're talking about a man, Tudor, who you describe as a diehard imperialist, clearly part of colonial rule and all that came with in many countries, India, Egypt, South Africa as well, then is what he did in Ireland. The quotes from him, I mean, he's clearly racist. In his,
you noticed that, didn't you?
It's difficult to read the quotes about Arab people, about the Irish, telling Churchill that Hitler seems like a good idea.
Yeah, let's make a deal with him and worry about these damned communists.
But the parallels that you talk about to the world we're living in now on several fronts, after all of that in Ireland, he is sent, Tudor is, to Palestine and thinks, remember those black and tans? That went so well. Let me bring them here. But what I think people maybe would be surprised to learn, unfortunately, is that they describe it as a boring, even paradise compared to what they experienced in Ireland. So to know that these, we're talking about the architects of the horrors that we're living through even now.
Yeah. They were, you know, Churchill was trying, he was trying to keep the Jewish population happy. After the Balfour Declaration of, I think, 1916 or whatever, Jewish immigration to Palestine started to increase, and then it started to increase exponentially, and the Arabs started to say, hang on, we didn't sign on for that. They didn't sign on for anything. This was a deal put together by the British, and the British had a mandate after the First World War over all of Palestine and Mesopotamia. And so they could basically do what they wanted. And so they sent in a new police force, basically, led by Tudor, with a whole lot more authority than he had in Ireland, and also black and tans, Irish police, or British-Irish police. So he got in there, and two things happened. First of all, they were trying to suppress the identity of this crowd that was being sent into to Palestine. Let them be associated with Irish. But it happened, and it had a good effect. The people who were going to cause trouble in Palestine suddenly says, we don't want to mess with the black and tans. And so it was kind of quiet, but the pressures were building. The Jewish population was increasing. The Arab population was becoming increasingly hostile. But it was manageable, and then the Lloyd George government fell. And then Churchill, for the first time in decades, wasn't in politics anymore. And the new people that came in, they didn't like Churchill's policy. They were not as friendly towards the Jewish migrations as Lloyd George's government was. And Tudor was basically removed from his position. So Tudor is now in Palestine. He's dumped his family, which is another part of the story that we don't have to go. He dumped them. And he can't go back to England because Sir Henry Wilson, who was part of his establishment, has just been shot down by two Irishmen on his own doorstep in Belgravia.
Like, so he thinks that could be me. I need to find a place to go. That will be me if I don't
keep my head down. The Irish tracked one of their own fellows who they thought was a traitor. They tracked him and killed him or shot him down in Central Park, New York. So they had a long reach. And Tudor was very much aware of that. And where is he going to go?
Newfoundland and Labrador, clearly.
Newfoundland and Labrador, why not?
Where else?
Why wouldn't he? But the big question is, why would he? He'd never been there. He heard of the place. Because when he was a young divisional commander in the First World War, he acquired a battalion made up of really ferocious Newfoundlanders. And they served well. They did great things in the war. And near the end of the war, one of the young Newfoundlanders under his command, 17 years old, he won the Victoria Cross for gallantry. And how he did it is in the book.
Yep.
You imagine this, your average 17-year-old kid today pulling off what that kid pulled off.
The juxtaposition of both of them near the end of the book, and people could read that, is quite striking. I think I felt what you were trying to suggest there. But given everything we've talked about Tudor, his racist views, how he behaved, dumping his family, the title of the book, the word accidental is in there. Is he not just a villain? Was this an accident?
Well, yes, it depends. I don't think he went in there with the understanding that he was going to go down in history as a villain. I think it was an incremental development of his job and his reaction to the job. And he just blundered into villainy and has been. I'm not even sure. You know, I know what you're asking me. Do you think he's a villain, McIntyre? And I'm not sure.
Well, the word accident, I hear what you're saying as well, but all of these things, he seems like a very bad person.
Let me be philosophical here. He was a person who did very bad things. Mm-hmm. And I always say, well, what was the motivation between the bad things that he did? First motivation was loyalty to the empire. Second was friendship with Winston Churchill. The third was a gut level anger, bitterness to what the Irish were doing to the people that he brought in there to suppress them. What nerve they had to fight back. Why didn't they just do what Englishmen would do, is like sort of sit down and talk? And this accumulation of motives in his own behavior turned him into what you have to call a villain. But I think it was a process that was cumulative, and therefore I think qualifies as accidental. I don't think the one awful event for which he should have been held accountable was what they call the Bloody Sunday Massacre at Croke Park. There was the Bloody Sunday Massacre in the morning where the IRA killed about 16 British officers just going bedroom to bedroom, knocking them off. And that would have turned the war against the Irish. It was so brutal. But, of course, the British military and the police, they just couldn't, like, let that sit. They go down to a football match, an Irish football match, chock-a-block with Irish Gaelic people. A football match in a place called Croke Park. It was a big game. And these cops ran, they weren't supposed to, but as soon as they hit the football match, they started to shoot. And they were under his command. And they killed fans, children. There were three or four children killed in this. And of course, that totally eclipsed the killings in the morning. And it was in Parliament, and it was in the media, and it was all over the place. And of course, overarching all of this is the fear by the British government about what do the Americans think? Because the United States had an extremely influential Irish American population. And the IRA and the Sinn Féin had people working that population, constantly raising money, winning friends, sowing influence. So Lloyd George always was looking over his shoulder. What are the Americans saying? And he and Churchill at one point actually warned that, you know what, if we don't get a handle on this, there's going to be a bigger war and the Americans are going to be on their side. We could have an international conflict with Britain and the United States on opposite sides. And Tudor wasn't aware of this. See, Tudor had no political savvy. He wasn't aware that all these political factors were playing out off stage. He's on the stage, and he's just saying, they're shooting at me, I'm going to shoot at them. They burned down a police station, I'm going to burn down a whole village. And so, this was going on in his mind. Meanwhile, this political game is going on backstage. And sooner or later, Churchill had to face the fact, you know what, you know, you've done great work. We're going to have to talk to these people. Yeah. Why? I'm winning.
People read for many different reasons. They might be history buffs. They want to learn about things that they don't know. Did you write this because you wanted people to learn something?
I wanted people to... Yes, but I'm not a historian and I'm not an academic. I was more I call this historical journalism. Mm-hmm. And I wanted people to be aware of the perils, as we started this conversation, the perils of setting aside your, turning off your moral compass and following orders, where that takes you. The perils of blindly following political leaders or any other kind of a leader when you know that what they're doing is wrong. It's going to create more problems than it's going to solve. That is a sort of a message I hope that some people will take out of this book. And also the individual, the peril for your individual, your personal reputation, the reputation of your whole family. When you get mixed up in this crap. And I'm looking around the world today, and you see the names in the newspapers. And we look at Trump, Netanyahu, Putin, but there's a small army of lesser names that pop up regularly who are enabling these guys to do the terrible things that are happening. And these are the people that are one day going to be sitting down. They're not going to be celebrated. No, there's going to be no monuments for them. But they're going to be asking themselves a lot of hard questions. And then maybe someday their grandchildren are going to be asking them hard questions. Were you there, Dad, or Grandpa, or whatever? What did you think? What did you really think? Did you really actually approve of that stuff? What's he going to say?
Lyndon McIntyre, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Neil, it's always a pleasure to be in your studio.
Thank you. Pleasure's mine.
That was longtime broadcast journalist and Scotiabank Giller Prize-winning author Lyndon McIntyre talking about his newly released book, An Accidental Villain, A Soldier's Tale of War, Deceit, and Exile, published by Penguin Random House Canada. He spoke to Neil in our Toronto studio.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.